The full name of Harry's project is the Southern Willamette Valley Bean, Grain, and Edible Seed Project. We've talked about beans and grains. Now we moved on to vegetable seeds.
We're also growing vegetable seed for our organic process here on this valley floor, which grows an immense amount of the vegetable seed for the world. People generally don't know this. It's about a $30 million industry here in the South Valley. So we have, people might know about the situation going on with the beets. There's a lawsuit been going on for over a year now. Basically, the organic industry suing Monsanto and the beet growers because 97% of the beet seed grown in the country is grown here, and almost 99% of that is genetically engineered. So I just wrote a paper, which I haven't sent out to anybody yet, called Who Gets to Grow Seed on the Valley Floor? Because we've been approached, one of our farms has been approached already by somebody from Beta Seed who wanted to know if they were growing chard seed. And the farmer thought real quickly and said no, but because what he's doing is the same thing I'm doing. We're growing our beet and chard seed in greenhouses now. We can't afford to have it outside where it's going to cross with genetically engineered crap. Mm-hmm. So these people, namely Monsanto, but a whole bunch of other people in the biotech industry, have what they've done is perpetrated on the world something that's far worse than terrorism. I mean, this is like insidious to the point that it gets out there in nature and it changes weeds. And we have a hard evidence from the Midwest of these super weeds growing from some of the biotech stuff. We're starting to get weeds around here. One of my scientist friends found them last year growing in the ditches down the road here. Chenopod weeds that lamb's quarter that are already, from his point of view, starting to change because of genetic engineering that's going on fields that are fairly close to them.
And the laws, court cases are siding with the seed companies. Our listeners are familiar with the case of the Canadian farmer, Percy
yes.
Schmeiser,
yeah.
who his neighbor was growing seeds licensed under contract with each farmer, seeds from, I guess it was Monsanto,
yeah.
And some of that blew in the wind onto Percy's farm. And Monsanto flew over, I guess, with a helicopter and saw this stuff growing there.
They had people walk in on his farm and take samples.
And sued him. He was just the victim of a strong wind.
This has happened all over the world. We have farmers in India committing suicide because of it. It's unconscionable. And the only thing that's going to change this, we're on the verge. This goes back to the Bean and Grain Project. We're on the verge probably within the next year to a year and a half of having genetically engineered wheat here in this valley. Now, when that happens, we're finished. And the only thing that can stop it is if the listeners of this program, probably this program and some other people that are working at this, raise up their arms and try to get a state law passed that the Ag Department has to enforce to stop it. The Ag Department's not going to do anything unless they have to enforce a law. We've already talked to them. They will enforce a law. We had this fight with... wanted to do canola here on the valley floor. The only thing that stopped that was that the Seed Growing Association, the $30 million industry, screamed and yelled because that canola seed can cross over into and provide diseases and pests for all the brassica seed that's grown here on the valley floor. So it got limited, but of course we still had test plots that OSU was running. This is enforced by the State Ag Department. The State Ag Department has to enforce what other people put forth as regulation and law, and that's the only way it's going to happen. The way it should happen, but there's no energy to do this, is we should overturn the case in 1980 that allowed for the patenting of life. It's a Supreme Court case, and it should be overturned. And in order to do that, we're going to have to overturn our government because Obama and the right-wing people, everybody is in favor of biotech. And these people are insane. Patenting life is insane. You know that Monsanto has applied for patent on a pig? I mean, these people are out of their heads. And until the general public raises up and does what has to be done to get legislation and anything else they can do to stop this, it's not going to be stopped worldwide, and we're the center of it.
People are daunted by, I think, international corporations like Monsanto and the federal government. You know,
we can't get President Obama to change. He does things politically. He's not a farm kid. Nope. But when you talk about going to one's local state legislator, that's more
doable.
It's doable. Yeah. It's within.
Yeah. Course. We have organizations in the state that have done these kinds of things before. OSPRIG, for instance, we can think of a lot of different organizations. There's a group in Eugene working on this right now. They had a big meeting 2 weeks ago. 100 people came to. So there is some legislation. Actually, I think on the computer I'm supposed to look at right now, there's some wording starting to be put together. There's people up in Washington. You know, this genetically engineered wheat is bad even for the chemical growers, because that means their white wheat that's here in the valley can't be shipped to Japan, which is one of their major – Japan's not going to buy GMO stuff.
Right, and the whole Eurozone won't buy it.
Yeah. So that's why it hasn't been put out yet. They tried to put it out a few years ago, and North Dakota blocked it. But they're making another attempt, so we've been told. And, of course, they did it with rice, and that's a – go on the internet and look at the rice thing. There's big lawsuits going on and everything else because it crossed over into the regular rice crop. So,
well, listeners, the Federal Communications Commission prohibits public and community radio stations from making what they call a call to action. However, I would note this. About half of the state legislators in Oregon are not from farm areas. They're from metropolitan areas, Portland and Salem and Eugene. They don't know all that much about agriculture. They only know what they hear from lobbyists at the state capitol and from their constituents. Next, I asked Harry about the difference between perennials, plants that keep coming up year after year, versus annuals, plants that live for 1 year and then die.
Another thing, since we're talking about the seed companies, grains developed as perennials, but now most every grain grown in modern countries, modern farming techniques, they're developed as annuals, and you have to go back to the seed company again next spring and get more. We've talked on this show with Wes Jackson of the Land Institute, and he's trying to reverse that. He's trying to, I guess, reinvent perennial grains.
Well, he originally pulled perennial grains from Russia, I know, in the early days, the Russian rye. And I've had some perennial grains growing here. Actually, I was able to, at least on a, we've done it for 6 years. We took a red wheat that OSU bred as a spring wheat, and it was grown out by Mark Stewart out in the hills out west of me here. And because it was in the hills in the Coast Range, he noticed that it perennialized. So I started fooling around with it here, and I noticed if it happened to get irrigation on it, it would at least go for 2 years. So I think some of these grains could be brought back in. Part of the problem here in this area is that we have this period like we have right now where the soils are bone dry unless you're irrigating them. So they wouldn't perennialize very easily. We might be able to adapt some variety to be like the perennial ryegrass that we have here in the valley.
Another step aside for a moment, I'm going to ask you, for the non-farmers in the audience, could you please explain hard wheat, soft wheat, red wheat, white wheat, spring wheat, summer wheat, wheat for bread versus wheat for pastry and noodles, just as briefly as you can manage it.
Okay. The soft wheat that's generally grown here on the valley floor, the soft white wheat, is generally used for pastry and noodles and chapatis and tortillas and flatbreads and biscuits and everything but raised bread. It can be actually used for raised bread, and I know people that have done it, but it isn't generally done that way. The hard wheats, either red or white, are generally what's used in they have a higher amount of gluten in, so people think that's what's needed to make raised bread. And they generally are spring planted, because when you spring plant something, it's easier to get a quick, you get a quick growth, and so then the nitrogen fertilizer that you put on runs the protein up. This is why people think that we have to have 14% for protein to make bread, is because we can run the protein levels up, and they do it in the Midwest all the time by using nitrogen fertilizers. Now, what we're doing with our red wheat here is it's grown with a very limited amount of fertilization, And the protein level in it, actually, when we check it, is below 12. It's right around 12, 11, something like that, which turns out to be great for making bread. Now, what I think is going on, and we haven't got the science for this yet, we haven't been able to find anybody to do it, I think when we grow grains organically, and they're on really well taken care of soil with the proper rotations, what we're going to get is a different set of amino acids available in that grain than we would have in a chemically grown plant. And I think we've got an entirely different product that probably people who are gluten intolerant might even be able to eat. I think a lot of gluten intolerance has to do with chemical agriculture and the way the grain is grown. And there's a little bit of evidence for that. But I think we have a lot of work to do to figure out what is this thing that we're growing that makes this incredible bread that Nature Bake is making. It's the best bread I've ever eaten. Everybody that I know that's eaten it goes, wow, this is incredible. Well, the flavors are coming. Those flavors, I have a feeling from working with Dr. Kapler, and you know him, the amino acids have flavors. And we get this in our vegetables all the time. Why wouldn't it be true in the grains? We just haven't done the work to figure out what's going on.
Dr. Kapler is Alan Kapler, a renowned seed breeder and scientist in Corvallis, who was guest on this show several years ago.
It's refreshing to hear someone who's spent a lifetime in an industry. The industry itself is, you know, thousands of years old. Refreshing to hear someone say, we're still trying to figure out the science of this. The components, amino acids and smaller things, you know, a flavor has, you know, hundreds of components in it.
Yeah.
And we've just been learning this in the last 10, 20 years.
In the transition document, one of the big inputs that Alan Kapler put into it, he put a couple of things in that are major, and that's one of the reasons everybody should read that book. One of the things that's in there is at least some of his amino acid research, which he got a standing ovation in front of a bunch of international biologists when he first did that research. Basically, the notion that we can eat a vegetarian diet and get all of our amino acids from such mixtures as, say, tomatoes and zucchini, or a really well-grown potato. We just need to check and see what it is that we've got available to us and start thinking in a different way. And then he went a step further and said we could adjust our diets for what we're doing. So if you're sitting all day in front of a computer, you want a totally different level of amino acids than you do if you're out digging a ditch or running a farm, you know. Mm-hmm. Different kinds of amino acids help us do different things differently. And we have the science available to us to be able to structure our diets that way now. It's amazing. The other part of that's in the book, it took me a while, but we got him to give a lecture at the 30th annual TILF conference on genetics and organic agriculture. And, you know, he's the one guy that I know that can sit down and read the genome, you know. So he gave the lecture. It was a wonderful lecture, greatly received, a great discussion afterwards. And then I got him to write it down, which I'll have to say isn't quite as good as the lecture because it's not his personality, you know, which is part of the lecture. But it's in the book, and you get to see what a world-class genius has to say about what we know that's going on with our knowledge of the genome now and how that has to be brought into organics. We can't close our eyes to it because it's science that's happening. How do we make use of it?
What about price to the retail customer? I know when most farmers, when they sell to a broker, they lose any control over what happens with their crop, including the eventual price to the retail customer or to the restaurant or store. You guys are trying to be vertically integrated.
Yes.
And hopefully to be the last one to get money out of it. Well, maybe next to last in the case of retailers. How concerned are you about the fact that organic food seems to cost more? And our listeners know why that is.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it has to be, just cost more to produce it. But how concerned are you, or are you going after a niche market that's willing to pay high prices?
Partially by accident, some of it is a niche market. We have the ability for people to get stuff directly off the combine. This is how we're set up. First of all, we want people to know that we're farmers that want to deal directly with customers. So if you don't have a lot of money and you want to put some storage away, you can buy directly off the combine uncleaned wheat and clean it yourself. Now, if you're going to get it cleaned, it's another 3 cents a pound, basically, so which isn't much. Yeah. So you probably want it cleaned. So we have coming up in November, we will have two different fill your pantry events. One will be in out here in the valley in a little town called Shed that's not very far from Corvallis. The other will be in Eugene. And what will happen with these events is that the word will go out to the community. You can pre-order, and you come show up at the event, and it's an attempt to get people to buy in bulk. And we sell it pretty rock bottom price. I mean, it's a lot of stuff went out last year, thousands and thousands of pounds the first time we did it. And then they did it again in Eugene, and the same thing happened. So both processed stuff and unprocessed stuff, and we include in these events potatoes, garlic, onions, fish, processed fish. I can't think. We've got a list of stuff. So that people can put away in their own household these products that are being grown locally here. We like people to pre-order so we know what we have to bring, because the trucks have to show up at this event with, we have to guess otherwise. We even have frozen meats.
So this will be announced on your website?
Yes.
So going back to one of the first things you said, that the supply, emergency supply of food, especially in cities here, but just in general, is very short, a couple of days, what's in the stores and so on, and maybe in elevators.
No, we don't have elevators.
All of
the infrastructure is gone. This is a big hole in this whole
Portland
thing.
We have elevators, but it's just for transshipping from Midwestern grain onto ships to Asia.
Or grain out of the valley. That's all the guys that grow grain here. We don't have any storage here. It all goes up and goes on the boats.
Okay.
It's Cargill.
That and plus the advantage for a consumer of buying in bulk. So this goes right back, these events you're going to have go right back to enabling people to get the staples into their pantry.
Yes. And we could put one of these events together for Portland. You know, it might be more grain and mostly grain oriented, but we could put an event together for, you know, if there was enough orders, we could set something, somebody could set something up there and we could drive trucks up and have the stuff same way. It'd be easier than having everybody drive down here to the valley, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are people from up in that area that have been coming down to these events and have been involved in the project, but we're trying to work more and more with growers in the North Valley. There's a whole group out in Forest Grove that has organized doing something sort of like Ten Rivers, trying to start working with. There's a huge grain area out there in Yamhill County. In fact, there's a grain named Yamhill. And there actually is some storage up there still, unlike down here. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that we can, over the next few years, get some stuff that's even in closer to Portland. But definitely this valley has the potential to grow 270 crops, and a good part of it has the potential to grow thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of grains, beans, and edible seeds. And we can feed, with the area we've got here, the whole of the Portland metropolitan area, the whole of the Eugene area, the whole of Salem, all these people. We're thinking 3 million people.
And meanwhile, half the land is being used to grow grass seed for pretty green lawns.
The grass seed industry took a huge hit during the economic downturn. Huge hit. A lot of guys on the verge of going out of business. So some of what's happened is some of that land has gone back into international wheat. The right south of Corvallis here, there's 5,000 acres that's irrigatable that used to be for cannery stuff. We used to have big canneries here in the valley. They're all gone. They all went to Chile and Argentina and stuff. So we have a lot of really good land here that can be used for a variety of crops. We just need to start thinking differently. And then we have to have two things happen. One is the consumer has to make the demand that they want the stuff grown locally and they want it grown organically. And the other is that the farmers start thinking, because of that, we really have a local market. And here's, you asked about price before. The grain that we grow in our project, we have an agreement with each other at Willamette Seed and Grain that the minimum that we'll pay a farmer is 50 cents a pound. Now, that's $30 a bushel. Now, what these guys growing white wheat for the international market are getting is usually $5 to $6 a bushel, and oftentimes by the time they get paid, which sometimes takes them a long time, it's closer to $4 a bushel. So that's the differentiation. And when a farmer starts getting $30 a bushel, it actually is paying their costs. It builds in the rotation possibilities because the wheat's going to bring in more than some of the other things like flax probably. And we start having the ground being able to be transitioned in a way that gets paid for. So when the consumer's buying that bread from Nature Bake or from some other bakery that's using our flour, one of the things they're doing is helping this transition. And when you buy that piece of bread, you're actually putting some money into a five-year transition of a field. Because we can only grow wheat on it one time. We might be able to monocrop it. We might be able to eventually perennialize it, but we don't know that yet. So at this point, we're doing very careful rotations because we know that that's what we should do. And we can run buckwheat, which doesn't bring in as much money. We can run oats, which don't bring in as much money. You know, we can run some legumes that don't bring in as much money. So That's what you're buying. You're buying the whole process, not just that piece of bread. It's the whole process.
Okay. Is there anything else I should be asking you? Anything else you'd like the listeners to know?
Well, I think in terms of our future here in the Valley, and this includes Portland, we've been in a, I just wrote a book about this, but we've been in a situation where we've had a heating up of the planet for a number of years, and we built this Bean and Grain project during that heat up. And we're coming post-2012, we're coming into a very slow, and we started it this year, coming back to what I would call more normal conditions in the Valley, which means longer, wetter springs and earlier, wetter falls, which means a shortened growing season. So it's kind of ironic to pull off what we've pulled off with the Bean and Grain project during the warm-up period, and now we have this huge challenge that I see in front of us the next 10 years to figure out some techniques using good organic methodology to try to offset what is going to be basically a cool down in our weather system. It isn't going to be noticeable to a lot of people, but for farmers, it's a big change for us already the last 2 years.